If we take a multi-pronged approach to first episode psychosis, can we impact schizophrenia?
Can a common vitamin prevent skin cancer?
Should you go in and have a total knee replacement?
And heart medications, are they available and are they affordable?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on October 23rd, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I am just so tickled by so many of these studies this week. It's hard to know where to start, but I think I am going to start with the American Journal of Psychiatry. This multi-pronged approach to first episode psychosis I served up and its impact on the incidence or the subsequent severity of schizophrenia.
This is important because schizophrenia is associated with enormous personal suffering and disability and family burden, premature death, and really a high societal cost. And I think it's well recognized that in general, we do a suboptimal job of delivering health care in the area of behavioral health issues. This was a study that looked at comprehensive versus usual community care for first episode psychosis. They looked at 34 clinics in 21 states for individuals that presented with their first episode of psychosis, provided whatever the usual community care was, or very comprehensive care. And that emphasized low-dose antipsychotic medications, cognitive behavioral psychotherapy, family education and support, and vocational and educational recovery. And they follow these individuals, and what's reported here is the two-year outcomes. There were 404 individuals in the study, and they measured a life scale that looked at things like what was their sense of purpose and what was their motivation and how well did they interact socially, emotionally. And what they discovered was that the comprehensive care for first episode psychosis significantly improved both functional and clinical outcomes. And more importantly, the effects were more pronounced for those that had a shorter duration of untreated psychosis. Why that's important is because the average duration of psychosis before treatment was initiated was 74 weeks, almost a year and a half, Elizabeth. If they initiated treatment earlier, the benefits were more marked than if they waited till later.
This, of course, is being hailed as a really important study with regard to our management of this particular condition. Of course, one of the things that is true about this is it's way more expensive to get folks into this comprehensive treatment than it is to just hand them a bunch of medicines or one medicine and say, I'll see you later.
That looks at the cost of treatment. It doesn't look at the cost of the effects of the psychosis or the schizophrenia. I think two things need to happen. This clearly shows that the treatment's more effective if you treat earlier. So we need to have earlier recognition and diagnosis. And then secondly, if we're going to positively affect these individuals and decrease societal burden and societal costs, then we need to use the most effective therapy. It is the comprehensive therapy.
Big emphasis, of course, right now on both recognition and management of mental health care issues in our society, and really an indictment of the way that we do it currently. Do you think that this is something that's likely to be adopted nationally?
It clearly can be administered in the community because this was a community-based setting. So that tells me it is transferable. Your question is a good one, and that is, will we absorb the cost, realizing that downstream will cost less? So I think that the better outcomes associated here and the community setting which is applied tells us that it needs to be done in the community and can be done.
Okay. That's the one I'm going to write about this week on the blog, by the way. Let's turn now to the New England Journal of Medicine, an ongoing issue, one that we've talked about on a multitude of occasions. That's total knee replacement. We've gone back and forth on, hey, is it really something you ought to do or you shouldn't do? And this prospective study may help inform us in that regard.
And since there are over 670,000 total knee replacements performed in the United States alone each year, this ends up being a huge issue. What about people that have mild to moderate or even severe but not debilitating osteoarthritis? Can those people be managed conservatively as opposed to having a knee replacement? What's the better outcome and which has the fewer side effects? And to address that, this Danish study took 100 patients with x-ray proven osteoarthritis, moderate to severe osteoarthritis and symptoms. And they randomized them to either a total knee replacement followed by non-surgical treatment, things like exercise, education, diet for weight reduction, use of insoles and pain medication. So one group got total knee replacement and non-surgical treatment for 12 weeks. The others just got some non-surgical treatment alone for 12 weeks. They followed them for a year. In the 50 individuals that had total knee replacement, they had fewer symptoms and better quality of life. Now, what about those that had just the non-surgical treatment? Well, only about a fourth of them went on to develop symptoms so severe they needed needed to have surgery, and their risk of adverse events, serious adverse events, was much less than those that had the surgery. So if you have surgery, your symptoms may be improved, but the risk of serious adverse events, things like infection, deep vein thrombosis, or needing additional procedures, is much higher after that than with a non-surgical therapy.
I think I'm a little bit dissatisfied with this conclusion just at the moment. I would love to see something that was really much more black and white with regard to this, because it sounds to me like it's devolved back to an individual choice.
This is a great example of you need to understand the patient's preferences. For example, if you say with non-surgical therapy, there's a 3/4 chance you won't need surgery and you'll have a quality of life that you'll be pleased with, that's a result most people can get their arms around. It really is very patient dependent. If it was you, Elizabeth, would you do the non-surgical treatment or would you rather have your knee replaced?
Well, as we well know, I have a terrible bias against surgery. So the likelihood that I would undergo total knee replacement is slim to none unless I really had no alternative.
Other people would say, gosh, I'd just like rather have the surgery. This study helps arm the patient with the information they need to make those decisions.
Okay. I'm still thinking it's a little equivocal, though. Let's stay in the New England Journal of Medicine. A good news study, I think, with regard to skin cancer. Gosh, can a common vitamin help us out here?
This common vitamin is nicotinamide, which is in the B vitamin series. We know that most non-melanoma skin cancers, basal cell skin cancer and squamous cell skin cancer, are caused by ultraviolet radiation exposure. The more often we're out in the sun and the longer the sun exposure, the more likely we are to develop not only melanoma skin cancers, but non-melanoma skin cancers. UV radiation causes the DNA to break, it inhibits the repair, and it suppresses the immune system. And it's known that nicotinamide can help alleviate some of those deleterious effects. So can something as easy as taking a couple pills of vitamin B, nicotinamide, help prevent skin cancer in high-risk patients? And that's what this study addressed. Well, they took almost 400 participants who before had two non-melanoma skin cancers within the previous 5 years. They randomized to placebo or nicotinamide, 500 milligrams twice a day, and they followed them for a year. The individuals that took the nicotinamide, it lowered their risk of developing new skin cancers by about 23%, both the squamous cell and the basal cell. It also decreased the precancerous lesions called actinic keratosis. And by the way, when they stopped the medication, that benefit went away. What's the adverse side effects? There weren't any. And by the way, it's really inexpensive. It usually costs pennies each day.
This is the kind of thing that we are generally prone to fall in love with and say, wow, this is really great. Maybe everybody ought to start taking nicotinamide. But we've been around a while, and often we see that, when we see this applied to a larger population or followed for a longer period of time, it turns out to be somewhat disappointing. So I'd ask you, what's your take home here?
Nicotinamide has been around for a long time. We've used it for a number of different uses. So I think this is one of those things that I would really encourage my patients that are at high risk, particularly those that have already had skin cancers, to take. I give two thumbs up to this particular study and the results.
All right, I'm marking this now. Let's see what happens in 2 years when we hear about the thousands of people who are taking daily nicotinamide and now we see something that we're like, I don't know about that one.
Ain't gonna happen, Elizabeth.
You don't think so, huh? You heard it here first. Let's turn then finally to The Lancet. Medicines intended to reduce cardiovascular risk. Hey, internationally, who's taking them, who isn't taking them, and why not?
The World Health Organization has targeted medications that prevent recurrent heart disease. Four different types of medication: aspirin, statins, beta blockers, and ACE inhibitors. WHO has targeted that these medications would be available in 80% of the communities and used by 50% of eligible patients by 2025. This particular group stratified high-income countries or medium-income or low-income. They asked, are the medications available in these countries and how is it related to the income level and are they affordable? In the high-income countries, these four medications were available to 90 to 95% of the communities. In low-income countries, 25% of urban settings and only 3% of rural settings. Do these medicines consume less than 20% of the income of the individual? Because many of these individuals have to pay out of pocket. The medications were unaffordable in only 0.1% in high-income countries, but they were unaffordable to 60% of individuals in low-income countries. Here's the disconcerting thing. In the high-income countries, only 18% of individuals took all four medications. What that tells me is we have a lot of work to do before we meet the WHO recommendations.
I guess I would also add to that in high-income countries, that constellation of different medications that people have to take to reduce their cardiovascular risk is often associated with side effects that are not terribly palatable.
And you're right. But what it does say is we've got a lot of work to do. And sometimes if there are side effects, there are alternatives we can use as well.
A really good point. And I would finally say that, gosh, a lot of those cardiovascular risk factors are modifiable and preventable. So if we could get into that instead of needing these medications at all, I think that would be a great thing.
So Elizabeth, you're going to highlight the psychosis study on our blog?
I am indeed. So that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.